Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give and there's no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off and every now and then or once every time you listen. It's up to you. Click on the supporter link that you can find in the episode or show description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your payment.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Scott Gray, aka Chapter from Melon Bomb, and you're listening to the House Culture Podcast.
House Culture.
Hello everybody and welcome to another episode of the House Culture Podcast, hosted by me, the managing editor at House Culture, Matt Rouse. Thanks so much for joining us today. We at House Culture are over the moon to be able to bring a little bit of the club directly into your home or wherever else you might be listening to this. If this is the first time you've tuned into the podcast, first of all, welcome. And second of all, please make sure you have a dig through our back catalogue of episodes, which feature interviews with the likes of Fatboy Slim, Tall Paul, Brandon Block, Greg Wilson, Terry Farley, John Satrencher, and many more. Even if you don't recognise the name, I guarantee you they have a fascinating story to tell. And if you've only just stumbled across House Culture and want to get to know us a little better, as I always say, we are a collective of house music fans who have come together through our mutual love of the beat to celebrate the spirit of house music. Instagram is where the party happens, and you can find us there at houseculturenet. Follow that and you'll get a daily dose of all things related to this scene we know and love. Let's get on with this next episode, shall we? In this one, we chat to the multi-talented Melon Bomber, Scott Gray. Not only is he part of the Melon Bomb DJ crew who have been entertaining the coolest of crowds in Ibiza for the past few years now, the resident of the island also produces and sells tasty artwork that has a distinctly Balearic flavour under his pseudonym Chapter. As you're here, we chat about his first visit to the island he now calls home.
Come on, we're going to Ibiza. And they dragged me out there in 97. And I remember going thinking, it's been done now. And it just absolutely blew my mind. Dancing in Manumission while the sun was coming up and then going to space afterwards. Just incredible.
What prompted the decision for Scott and his wife to make the permanent move to the White Isle?
I woke up with a cold sweat one morning and just said to my wife, I've got to give up work. I've had enough. It's killing me. And she suggested trying a summer in Ibiza. So I quit my job, bought a van. Didn't know what I was going to do. I thought if I'd buy a van and take it to Ibiza, I could earn with it. I went over there and it worked out all right.
How the first meeting with his fellow Melon Bomb crew went.
I've got a meeting with Paul Reynolds and Ben Santiago about this really good idea, and I've got no idea what it's going to be.
And where the name for their collective came from.
That's great. So what should we call it? Melon Head? Melon Disco? Melon Bomb.
Before we get started, I must say that this conversation was recorded before anyone had even heard of this thing called the coronavirus. So there is some chat about dates and whatnot in here. Obviously, these are either not happening or TBC. So please check the current situation if you hear about something you like. This is going to be a good one. Prepare to get jealous and start packing those bags for your move to Ibiza. This is Scott Gray.
House Culture.
Hi, Scott. We at House Culture, so happy to sit down with you for the House Culture podcast. welcome.
Thank you.
You're part of the award-winning Melon Bomb Collective that has been setting Ibiza alight for the past few years with an explosive mix of house and disco, playing at Glitterbox, Pasha, Pikes. But before we come on to talk about all of that, and obviously your artwork as aka Chapter, what we want to know is, what was your first exposure to house music?
Wow, my first exposure to house music. Well, I guess it would have been 1988 when I was a massive hip-hop head, I suppose. But there was house music sort of seeped into popular culture in a way, didn't it? There was a couple of tracks that came out, Love Can't Turn Around, stuff like that. And it was just, I suppose, it was a faster version of the electro kind of scene that we were into. So it kind of came in that way. But I was never properly into house music as such until probably 1990 when I took my first pill.
And where was that then?
It was actually with my brother and some mates on a pub crawl, believe it or not. and my brother thought it'd be a good idea for us to take these, and we loved it.
Older brother then?
My younger brother, actually. Yeah. No, my brother's 4 years younger than me, but was a bit more advanced than me when it came to illicit substances.
Yeah.
So he got us all on these pills, and we had a great night. And then the next thing to do was, which was probably a month or two later, was to actually go to a club and experience that. Yeah. And we did, and then all of a sudden house music made total sense.
Of course it did.
Yeah.
So what was that? Was it just the combination of the music, the people, the vibe all together, or was there one thing in particular?
Well, I mean, I'd been to the odd rave before, but I hadn't, like a few, couple of illegal ones, but I hadn't taken anything. For whatever reason, I maybe had a spliff instead, but I didn't think pills were for me at that point. So I'd have been 18, 19 then. And then when we went to Club UK was my it was my first proper experience with combining the house music with MDMA or ecstasy, and it was everything. When it was just everybody was on the same vibe, there was so much love in the air. It was just like, it was a bit like a religious experience, I guess.
Yeah. And so were you hearing these tracks and were like, I want to own this music and become a DJ, or was it just something just to do for?
At that point, I was just happy to dance my ass off to it and put my hands in the air and enjoy it. No, I don't think I had any intention of DJing at that point. That came a little bit later, and I don't even know if I can pin that down to a particular point. Probably a couple of years later, and a friend of mine, I had DJ friends actually, I'm thinking about it now, one of which was Paul Jackson, who went on to do some really good things with Underwater, with Darren Emerson, and that kind of stuff. And he was quite successful for quite a while, actually. And we'd follow him around. He was one of the original Ministry of Sound DJs.
Yeah.
So we'd go and watch him play there. And I guess, and I suppose we all kind of bought records anyway to listen to them at home. And then I think another one of my friends got some decks at home, my friend Martin, actually. And we'd go around his house and play the records and try and mix. And then roll on a few more years. Some friends of mine were doing a little event at a bar in Notting Hill called, I can't remember the name of the bar now, it'll come back to me later. And they asked me to come along with my record collection, and at that point I was just playing funk and soul, really.
Mm.
Even though I liked house music, I thought I'd play that kind of sound instead.
Yeah.
And that was kind of my first steps into DJing.
Yeah, and to have kind of a basis, I think, sometimes in that funk and soul sound, and even with hip-hop as well, that sampling culture, especially with house music, you kind of discover where a lot of these tracks have been kind of born from.
100%, yeah. I mean, it's all about the sampling. Even now, when we're making tracks now, you know, we love the sampling side of it, especially as none of us are in the Melon Bomb musicians. So if we're making stuff, we tend to be using other people's stuff and changing it a bit.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
So you mentioned Ministry of Sound as well. Was that kind of did that figure in your kind of clubbing life early doors? Or?
Yeah. As I say, we'd go and see Paul play there and plenty of other nights as well. So yeah, we loved the Ministry, and the Cross was a massive part of our.
I used to love the Cross.
Yeah.
So many of these we've done, and lots of people mention the Cross, and I think just my reaction every time is, I used to love the Cross.
If you're a Londoner and you were into house music in that era, the Cross was was like the mecca. And actually, I was talking to some friends a couple of days ago about how things are going in Ibiza, and we were talking about Pikes, and the Cross and the Pikes, there's kind of similarities to it, aren't there?
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of small, like, environment, low ceiling, sweaty, but just eclectic, dark. I don't know if they're the right words, but you know what I mean? It's that kind of similarity.
Yeah, like a throng, like everyone's in there together. Yeah, it's like, have you been back to that area of King's Cross
Do you know what?
Since the regeneration?
No, I haven't. But I've seen the odd I haven't now. Yeah, maybe a couple of years ago, but I haven't gone back to the site where the cross is.
Mm.
But I'm sure somebody showed me an image of it recently, and it's still unused, so it could still have been a nightclub.
Yeah, no, it's definitely just now sells like high end furniture.
Oh, it does. Ways. Oh, yeah. Okay, fair enough.
And where the DJ booth used to be, they've knocked out the back wall.
Oh, really?
And so it's open. There's a canal back there, which I never knew.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Kind of weird. You kind of stood there, and you can kind of squint and see, but yeah, it's those days are long gone.
There was a night there called Cheeky People that was one of the first nights I had in there, and that was a monthly on a Saturday. And again, Paul Jackson used to play at that, so we'd go and watch him. And we still talk about those nights now. Some of the times I had in there.
And what was the kind of genre of music during that era? Was it kind of, I mean, what years for this? Would you say?
It would have been 92, 93 maybe,
yeah,
around that kind of era. And it was a mixture between sort of funky house, was quite big, what they call funky house then, and a kind of mixture of that and a slightly sort of tougher sound, I suppose, was the music we were kind of following in, places like the Cross and the End, and we would have used to go other places like that, and even Trade we used to go to sometimes to see Tony DeVitt play and people like that. So
yeah
it was that kind of, it had a soulful edge to it, I guess. And that's kind of my love of that sort of more soulful sound in house. Probably came from that sort of era.
Yeah, and it
the Bomb.
Like,
do you remember The Bomb when that first came out? The first place
Bucky
I heard.
Heads.
Yeah, Buckyheads. And the first place we heard that was obviously Kenny Dope. The first place I heard that was in The Cross, and it just blew our minds. It was just incredible.
Yeah.
This is when we're all off our heads.
Yeah.
Just, what is this?
Amazing. And so, what was your first experience with Ibiza? Was you like, okay, this is the Mecca, is Ibiza, I need to get there, or did you just discover it?
Yeah, the Mecca is Ibiza, and was becoming Ibiza, you know, from the, obviously the whole scene was born there with the famous four that came back and brought that whole acid sound and the drugs and everything to London. But I never got there till 97, and the reason for that is I had a child when I was 21, and my mates were going on these kind of boys' holidays where I was stuck at home with doing the family bit. But in 97... Me and my son's mother at the time, we parted ways, and the boys to sort of try and cheer me up to come on, we're going to Ibiza. They'd all been going for a couple of years, and I've been going on about how great it was, and they dragged me out there in 97. And I remember going thinking, oh, I've missed it, I've missed the boat. You know, it's the whole scene is, it's been done now. It's you know, it's nothing new about it now, and it just absolutely blew my mind. It just as they told me it would. You know, dancing in Manumission while the sun was coming up, and then going to space afterwards, was just unheard. It was just incredible.
I mean, it's nuts how, like you say, you got there, it'd been going almost like 10 years, I suppose, and you're thinking, oh, it's over, I've missed it. You experienced that, and even now, you know, 30 years later, it's still going, still reinventing itself, and you guys have had a part in that, I suppose.
Well, it is still doing that, and it's still having that effect on people, and even now, you know, people, you got a lot of people sort of saying, oh, Ibiza's over, it's dead, the scene's dead. They keep, you know, you hear that every year, and it's not. It's still very much alive and kicking. All the best DJs in the world go there. It's still the Mecca of house music. And even though there's a lot of not brilliant music going on there, there's still a lot of brilliant music going on there, and brilliant DJs and very creative people still go there. We got some friends that had their son came over with a load of his friends for the first time, and they were all, what, 20-year-olds, 21-year-olds.
Yeah.
And just, we spent some time with them, not necessarily at the clubs, but just, you know, we had dinner with them a couple of times and went around their houses. And they were just, they had that same wide-eyed expression, that sort of, they couldn't believe what they were witnessing. It blew their minds too.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's sort of 30 years later after the scene had started, it's still having that effect on people when they go for the first time, and it's never too late to go to Ibiza and experience that, it seems.
No,
which is great.
Yeah, even, you know, you'd think kind of kids or, you know, older kids would go with their parents, and if their parents have been going to this thing, going on about it, the kids would just kind of push against that and be like, actually, it's what my dad does, it's not cool, but it's still got that cachet, it's still incredible and pushing on forward.
It does seem a little strange, though, doesn't it, that generation wants to do what we did, because we never wanted to do our mum and dad.
No, I don't know what it is. I don't know whether it's in my mind, I was thinking like things like the 90s or whatever almost seems like the 60s in a way.
Yeah.
And that era of music in the 60s kind of like did its thing and then died a death. Whereas this has never gone away.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's just continuing to move forward.
To the point where my son himself, he says he never had his punk house or hip hop moment. Like we in our, punk was a generation above us a bit, but we certainly had like a hip hop movement changed our lives. The house movement changed our lives, and they've never had that kind of absolute rock and roll movement that we had. You know, we had a few of them in our generation, and they haven't had that. And it's a strange thing. I don't know what the reason for that is. I hope the next generation discovers something new for themselves. But having said that, you hit on a point there where you said about the '60s. I remember when, you know, the whole Summer of Love kind of thing came out and we were all taking LSD and mushrooms and pills and what we were doing. And spliff, we were very much referencing the '60s, weren't we?
Yeah.
With the art and the culture and stuff like that. So we were kind of looking back to that era in a way. So I suppose there is an element of that. But as you say, but then that died and came out. And weird. I don't know.
Strange. Yeah, it's an interesting... So like in 100 years time, they look back on this and be like, are the house music still going? or what happened? How did this kind of push on exist?
Half of me hopes that it's still going. Half of me hopes that the kids find something new, you know, that they can claim for themselves.
Yeah.
You know, you've got grime and stuff like that, I suppose. But, you know, it feels to me like it's just another version of hip hop, whatever.
Yeah.
Perhaps the kids would disagree with me.
It's a lot of things. Everything's kind of fragmented in the way now that if you have a niche, you can find your niche, but you can find it kind of online, I suppose.
Yeah.
Whereas like, it was all kind of a real community when house music blew up in Summer of Love. You know, it's 1-to-1 and...
It was never that international, apart from in Ibiza.
Yeah,
if you know what I mean. I think we definitely packaged it and took it back to Ibiza and made it what it is today.
Yeah,
the Brits, you know,
absolutely. And didn't you meet your wife on the dance floor?
So that year in '97, when my friends dragged me out there, kicking and screaming against my will, it wasn't quite like that. But they did have to. They kind of said, "No, you're coming." You know, and I went, "All right, okay." So I'm just very, very thankful for that, because it totally changed my life in a way that's...
multiple ways.
Yeah, multiple ways. We were there. We went to Space and I bumped into my wife, as she is now,
No way. Did you know each other beforehand, or were you just...
No. I'd seen her at the airport.
Yeah.
She was travelling with a friend of mine, Dave, who's now become a really good mate of mine. I used to go watch West Ham with him for years after that, until I moved to Ibiza. And I was with all my mates and we were all... typical boys abroad, you know, in our mid-20s, late-20s, just getting up to all sorts of nonsense. And then she came up to me in Pasha on the Wednesday night, the night we arrived there, and said something to me, but I was so off my face, I couldn't even speak. I just, so she went away probably a bit disheartened. but then I saw her again in Space and we got chatting. And actually, she came up to me and she said to me, have you farted? I said, no. And she said, what, never? That's the girl for me.
Oh, there you go.
That was our chat up line, yeah. And brilliant. So we've been together ever since. Then we got married a couple of years later. And
incredible.
And then we'd go on holiday there every year.
Yeah.
You know, every summer we'd go there for a couple of weeks. Sometimes we'd go twice. And then in 2010, we were over there on holiday. During this time, I'd been working in recruitment, even though I DJed and did art for fun as a hobby, but it was never a career. And it was so in 2010, we were over there on holiday. I woke up with a cold sweat one morning. And just said to Mandy, my wife, I've got to give up work. I've had enough. It's killing me. I'm not a recruiter. I wanted something else in my life. I don't know what it is. We didn't have a lot of money in the bank at the time because we'd put it all back into the house we had. So we were just like, let's go travelling for a bit. We've got a little bit. It'll get us by. And then she suggested trying a summer in Ibiza. So we did in 2011.
Wow.
So I quit my job in 2010. And in May 2011, I bought a van. I didn't know what I was going to do. I thought if I'd buy a van and take it to Ibiza, I could earn with it. No, honestly, I had no idea what I was going to do.
Yeah.
I went over there and, it worked out all right.
No way. So you actually drove the van to Ibiza?
So we packed up our stuff that we needed to... We rented somewhere for 6 months, a tiny little apartment in Figueretas. Mm-hmm. Really, really simple. Little two-bedroom apartment. And I went over there with a van. I thought, we're going to do this van. Once I got there, sort of asked around, couldn't find, work wasn't as easy as I thought it would be. I thought, everyone, I want a man with a van in Ibiza. But it turns out there's quite a few vans over there already.
There's always some vans on the island.
Yeah, and I did a bit of a hippie thing. I went to Escabel's, you know, I looked over, it's one of my favourite views on the island, and I just, when we used to go there on holiday, we'd sit there and just go, how can we make it work? How can we live here? What do we have to do? You know, it turns out you just have to go and do it. It's as simple as that. But you don't realise that when you're trapped in your job and your career and your life and stuff. Anyway, so I sat on the edge of the cliff at Escabel's and I spoke to the island, much as you might speak to the universe. Now, I'm very much into that kind of thinking. But at the time, I didn't know this, what I was doing. And I guess I was talking to Tanit or whatever. And I just said, all right, you've got me here. what do you need me for? And literally the next day, because I put the feelers out, a phone call came in from somebody saying, oh, I've got this guy who's looking for a roadie. Do you know how to set up DJ equipment? And I was like, yep. Mm-hmm. And it was a guy called Eric, who's one of the part owners of Void. So I ended up working for him, using my van to move sound equipment around the island.
Typical Ibizan labourer.
that's what it was. Yeah, I was basically a labourer. I was just a pair of hands just umping speakers and sound equipment about and occasionally being allowed to plug it in, you know?
Yeah.
Not too technical.
How tough was that to begin with? Did you look back on that and think those were tough times, or were you just enjoying?
Do you know what? Yeah, I mean, I'd had a very stressful kind of mid-management role in the UK. So anything that wasn't that was great, and I was prepared to give it my all. And we used to work some crazy hours. You know, we'd be like setting up sound equipment for a wedding, perhaps. Then I'd be delivering some speakers to some kids that were renting a villa they wanted for that. Then we'd be going into DC10 to take out some big speakers at 6 a.m. that we were moving to Sankey's, because they had the Void sound system at the time. So it was kind of a mixture of those sort of things. And it was just stupid long hours for the summer, but I absolutely loved it. I loved it because I wasn't doing what I was doing before. I was living in the Ibiza and it was in the sun.
Yeah.
And it wasn't every day. It was always kind of a bit sporadic. There'd be like 2 or 3 days where you'd be flat out, then you'd maybe have 4 days off, or it was kind of, you know, sort of plenty of sort of downtime. And my wife, actually, who before we moved to Ibiza, she used to travel around the world for H&M delivering training. Okay. And she got a little job in a shop. Which she still works there now. She just works there three days a week in the winter.
Yeah.
In the summer, sorry, and then has the winter off. So she's still there now and just loves it. Yeah.
So everyone's, you know, assume most people listening to this have been to Ibiza in the summer usually. Uh-huh. What are those winter kind of months like on the island?
It's just the best. It's absolutely brilliant. The first year we went, we only did 6 months and we came back to the UK for 6 months. And during that time, we'd met some really nice people. Actually, there was a Spanish bar at the bottom of the road we used to go to. And one of the sister of the bloke that owned the bar, the Spanish friend, a girl and her friend, came over and stayed with us actually in London for a few months, which was really good. Yeah. And then we went back. So the second year, we couldn't find... We went back the second year in 2012, and we thought we'd just do 6 months again, rented a house out in London. But when we got there, it was difficult to find somewhere for just 6 months, so we just decided we'd stay and keep the people in the house. Yeah. So we stayed for our first winter, and it was just magical. I just remember thinking, this is just brilliant. The weather was still pretty good. It was mild, a lot milder than it is in the UK. It got cold at night when the sun went down, but there was just still loads of people on the island, but it was just a totally different vibe. And I'd heard how beautiful it was, but you really got to explore the island and really get yourself ingrained into the people of Ibiza. Yeah. You know, it really helps if you want to sort of build a career there, I guess. Spending time in winter.
I suppose was then the thinking, like, I'm really going to ingratiate myself to the community at large and, you know, learn Spanish. I've got to do this? Or?
We're still trying to learn Spanish now. My Spanish friends still give me shit for it not being as good as they'd like it. But it's better than a lot of my other mates that live there.
Yeah.
So I'm quite pleased with my level of Spanish. My wife's better than I am.
Yeah. So you're fully based on the island now as an entity. That's it. It's 100%. This is going to be.
We sold up a house here and bought over there, bought an apartment there.
And how many different places have you lived on in the island? Are you settled where you are?
We're settled now. Yeah, we've got an apartment in Santa Hilaria, overlooking the church and the sea. It's very nice.
Why not? Okay, so we were talking earlier before we put the mics on, but I just want to go through the DJing as well as the artwork on the island. Kind of what came next after you being the labourer, man with a van, and semi-plan.
I guess even in the first year of doing the sound systems, I took a small amount of records over with me in the hope that I might DJ at a friend's party or something like that, because I DJed before in London, as I said, in bars and stuff. So I had experience of it, but I never imagined it would be a career. So I took a bunch of records over me, and I got a couple of gigs. And like, there's a little bar down the road from me. We were living in Salinas the second year we were here, called La Salle, which is now Coricancha. I started to DJ in there, and then I started to DJ in Sands a couple of times. I went and saw Jason Ball, that owned it at the time, and just asked him if I could play a few records one lunchtime. He said, "Yeah, come down once a week if you like. Come and play." I think he paid me a burger and chips or something. Oh, yeah.
Is that one of the main benefits of living on in Ibiza as well, would you say? Like, you just say, oh, can I come and play? Or you're around tomorrow at lunchtime?
Pretty much, yeah. Everybody kind of does that. A lot of people that want to be DJs do that. Mm. But I guess because I didn't it wasn't like the be all and end all for me. And I know it, like you do get a lot of people over there quite desperate to do it.
Yeah.
And they'd really push you about it. And you know, if anybody wants to be a DJ, you have to, you've got to make it happen, haven't you? So
yeah.
you go about it any way you can. But because I never considered it would be a career or something I desperately wanted to do, because I kind of had a bit of, I started a career. I thought I was going to do sound systems all my life over there. I wasn't desperate about it. So I suppose when I went to people and just said, oh, can I play a few records? They were just like, yeah, why not? They could see that I wasn't desperate for it. Yeah. I don't know. That's the only thing I can assume that kind of helped me in a way.
Yeah.
So the second year I was over, when we did our first winter there, I decided to start drawing again. I thought I was going to just get back into my artwork, because I had studied art years ago. I did a foundation course in art and then dropped out after I had my son, or just before I had my son, and ended up doing recruitment. So I rediscovered my art the first winter we was over, which is 2012. And it was our wedding anniversary and we didn't have a lot of money. So I decided I would draw a card for my wife. Mm-hmm. And it was made up of a sugar skull with stuff in it that was relevant to our lives. And I drew that and it was quite nice and she loved it. And then I drew another one just for me, really, just for the sake of doing it. And a friend of mine saw it and said, oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Can you blow that up for me? I was like, how am I going to do that? Okay, so, because he basically commissioned me to make one for his wall.
Mm.
So I had to get a computer software because I needed to redraw it on a computer so that when I blew it up, the quality wouldn't lose. So that kind of started my digital art career, really. And then I designed some T-shirts that winter as well, which I had made in Bali the following summer. I sold them in Ibiza, and then just cashing out. There's no money if the tax man's listening to it. So I started to draw again, and then I got more into the kind of digital art stuff, and then I designed a smiley I did, and then I got involved with Last Night a DJ Save My Life charity.
Yeah,
they started to see that I was doing art and started to sell prints and stuff. And by the end of that year. I was over here in the Houses of Parliament selling art alongside Banksy and Inky and stuff like that. It was a really quick sort of rise. I don't know how it happened, really. But just, I guess, right time, right place, whatever you. And people in Ibiza sort of liked what I was doing. And, you know, I was starting to get commissions for stuff. And
yeah.
So I decided to start making prints, and I made scarves and T-shirts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And people kind of liked it. So that happened quite quickly. At the same time as that happened, I was DJing for fun. I was DJing at a party in the winter, my mate Gary's. It was his birthday. I might have been his 30th or 40th. Anyway, I was DJing at his party, and Vaughan Africa, who used to run the Funky Room, still is involved in the Funky Room on a Saturday night, in Pasha, spotted me and asked me if I would do a bit of covering for him for when Pippi or Willie Graff weren't playing.
Yeah.
So when they weren't available.
What music were you playing?
So then I was playing funk and soul, really, because it was a Funky Room. With a little bit of sort of soulful house. And I remember, and I did that for the first time with Pippi, and it wasn't as good as an experience as I hoped it would be.
Oh, really?
No, I thought it'd be great. This is my moment, you know, and it didn't quite go as well as I thought. But he taught me a very, very valuable lesson. Because I was playing like these original vinyls and stuff, and some of the quality wasn't as good, and it's very, very, very difficult to mix and to transition.
Yeah.
Some of those tunes, and he kind of got me into edits. He sort of gave me a really good bit of advice, and saying, you know, get into edits, they're in time, you can mix with them, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And that kind of sort of set me down that path.
It's a rabbit hole, isn't it, once you discover that.
It is, and then I kind of, you know, because when I started to DJ in Ibiza, I had no intention of DJing really professionally, as I said, and I had no intention of being a house DJ, because I thought, when I did start to go get pulled in, I thought, well, there's no point doing a house, everybody and his mum's doing a house.
Yeah.
There weren't that many soul and funk DJs or funk and soul DJs, so it felt like I was a bit of a novelty, so therefore I might get a bit of work doing that, because I love doing that, and that's kind of what happened, really. It did me well.
Yeah.
But then I got back into my house music again, which I always listened to and danced to and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
I just didn't think I'd ever be playing again.
Okay. And obviously DJing alongside Pippi, you know, that's mildly terrifying, I'd imagine, as well.
It was. The first few times, it really was, actually. He gave no quarter,
really,
shall we say. I get on well with him now, of course.
Yeah.
But at the time, he was a bit wary of me, I think. And he probably thought, what a shit DJ this guy is. But because my mixing wasn't great at the time. Mm. Some would argue it's not great now, but, but anyway, I'm joking, I hope. It was difficult at first, but once I got into the edit side, it became easier.
Mm.
And also, that's the same year that happened, I got asked to do Pasha. Another guy who's become a really good friend of mine, Bob Masters, was over on the island in the May time. And some friends of ours had a bar called Hidden. Chris and Amanda, the Boggled Hidden up in the north, and I'd DJed a few times at their daytime events, you know. They had like Easter parties and stuff like that, and they were doing a night with Ashley Beadle was coming over to who was a really good friend of theirs, was going to play that afternoon, and they asked me if I wanted to play alongside him. I was like, yeah, of course, amazing. Yeah. He's a legend.
Yeah.
And he became a friend, actually. He's a good mate now. So another guy called Bob Master spotted me playing that day and asked me if I wanted to go and play on the boat for his Ibiza Soul Week, which I did, and then got asked to come back and do the fourth in the year after. So Pasha and Soul Week happened more or less at the same time.
Yeah.
Which would have been 2013 or 2012 or 13. It would have been 13.
Yeah. And then in 2014, you had the epiphany while talking to some other fellow DJs.
Yeah.
About Melon Bomb.
So Melon Bomb was born in November 2014. We were at a wine event where they were having food at a place
On Ibiza.
In Ibiza, yeah, called Vino & Co. It's a very famous wine shop. And we know the guys that run it really well. Really good friends of ours, Dutch family called the Hammersmiles, own that place. And I'd met actually Paul Reynolds' mum and dad. Me and Mandy had met them in there drinking wine. So we sort of became mates of them because we met them a few times. And they used to say to me, "Oh, do you know Paul Reynolds, our son? And he's doing well in Ushuaia and stuff." And I'd say to him, "No, do you know what? I keep hearing about this guy, and I'm sure our paths will meet, but we haven't yet." So anyway, this wine event happened not long after that, and he was there with his missus, and Ben Santiago was also there with Laura.
Yeah.
And I'd just been asked to do Pasha on New Year's Eve, so it was a bit of a big break for me. Those guys were already doing really well themselves, and I'd had a few drinks, and I said to them both, "I've got a great idea, let's get together. Can we have a meeting next week?" And we decided we'd meet on Tuesday. And afterwards, Ben sort of told me that he spoke to Paul, and he said, "Who is this guy? Do you think we should speak to him?" And Paul was like, yeah, let's give him a go. Let's hear what he's got to say.
Yeah.
And I woke up on the Saturday morning, because it was on a Friday, the first, when I made the suggestion, and I said to Mandy, "I've got a meeting with Paul Reynolds and Ben Santiago about this really good idea, and I've got no idea what it's going to be." I didn't have a clue. But Glitterbox had just started that season in Boom, and I'd been along to it and really enjoyed it, and I thought we could do, it was like the resurgence of that more kind of soulful scene, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, the disco had come back into house, and fair play to them, Glitterbox totally nailed it. You know, they kind of were part of that scene, kind of that re-emerging scene of nostalgic kind of more soulful sounds.
The edits, you could argue, kind of invented that as well. Yeah,
that's it. Yeah, probably right, actually. Yeah, the edits and it kind of brought singing back into house, didn't it? Really, you know, that soulful kind of vocal stuff and the, you know, the music back to what was a really strong tech house scene at the time.
Yeah.
So I guess we just decided to do something along those lines, and that's how Melon Bomb was formed. And then I'd also played at Pike's for a friend's wedding that October, so just before we had the meeting. So I was able to convince, and then they liked me and they asked me to come back and play at Halloween. So I knew that Pike's did winter parties. So before we even had the name Melon Bomb, or we knew what we were going to do, not long after our first meeting, I'd managed to speak to Pikes, and they gave us a party in February. They gave us a date. And then we had a meeting with Paul and Ben. I think it was our second meeting in January, maybe, or February. No, it was January. And I brought a piece of artwork along, which was I don't know if you've ever seen the Melon Bomb logo. It's the bomb and the face and the beard. So I brought that along to the meeting, and I designed it as an art piece to sell that winter, alongside two other pieces of art. And the other ones sold really well, but nobody was interested in buying that Melon Bomb. And I was really upset because it was my favourite piece of design at the time. So I brought it along to the meeting. I said to the guys, "Should we use this?" And they were just like, "Yeah, that's great. So what should we call it? Melon Head? Melon Disco? Melon Bomb." And that's where the name was formed. So we had the date in Pikes. We had the name. And we did our first party. Paul was unavailable. I think he might have had a gig in the UK. So me and Ben did it with, who else did we use? Oh, Paulette, DJ Paulette.
Yeah.
And about 40 people turned up. By about half past 2, 3 o'clock, it was empty. And we were just, we had a go.
Yeah.
Can't see that happening again. But Pikes were good enough to give us one more date. So Pikes gave us a second date. And it was our friend's, Nick Clayton's, big birthday. And he double booked it. And he booked Joe Mills to play because he wanted more of a kind of DC-10 sound, because she was one of the old DC-10 DJs, wasn't she? And Pikes had also promised it to us. So we kind of got together and combined it, and Joe Mills played for us and played a more disco kind of soulful sound, actually, which was really good. And that was our second Melon Bomb party. But because it was his birthday, a load of people came down. And then people kind of saw us and thought, "Oh, this is good." And so Pike sort of recognised it as well.
Yeah.
And then gave us, they were just giving us at that point more or less a party at a time. But we ended up kind of doing more or less, I think, from May to September, maybe October once a month.
Yeah.
And that was our first kind of year at Pikes. Yeah. And Melbourne was born. And actually, we had it went okay. They had other things going on as well. Car wash were there, and there was a few other parties that was that they had. But by the end of it, we did our closing party actually. Yeah, the first year at the end of October, and about 500-600 people came, and we were just like, wow.
Yeah.
We were onto something here.
Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You kind of mentioned there was like Halloween at Pikes, you know, your first gig there was February, and then it went into March. You know, these are all kind of like out of season in that way. What are the, you know, you mentioned the island is really good when you're living there in the winter time, the out of season time, but there's still events going on. What are the crowd like? Is there a different vibe in those parties?
No, they're all house lovers. They all went there to follow house music and to follow the, you know, I always call the beats and the pills, you know. So they're all into that sound. Pretty much everybody there loves it, you know. It's why we're there, really.
Yeah.
And then we discovered how beautiful the island was, so there's a difference in it. It's a slightly different personnel. It's not people that are on holiday, but even the people that go on holiday are regulars. They know what's what. They understand the music, they know about the clubs, you know. It just is the best crowd to play to. It was predominantly a UK crowd, I guess, and that whole kind of sound still is, to an extent. It seems to be more of a kind of UK. We seem to love our soul more, perhaps, than say the Europeans do.
Yeah.
But it's got a bit more mixed now. So we've got quite a few Dutch people come down, and Italians and, you know, Germans and Spanish come too. But it's still probably predominantly English.
Yeah.
I also have to say, so not long after we did our second party, I'd started working with Juan Corby, mm-hmm. who is the fourth Melon Bomber. Now, when we did an edits track together, which we put out, I did the artwork for it and put it out on vinyl. And I think Paul had started to do an edit with him as well. We got a gig in, unbelievably, we got our first gig in space, like in May, through Paul Reynolds, because Paul was a regular there. And he managed us to got us on a Wednesday night or something. I can't remember whose night it was that we were playing at, but we were playing on the, was it on the roof or the terrace? Yeah, it was unbelievable how that happened.
Yeah.
But it did. And Ben wasn't available, so Corby, who we'd been working with, was available, and we said, "Oh, do you fancy coming to play?" He was like, "Yeah, great." And after that night, we were just like, "Great, that's our fourth member then." And that was the four Melon Bombers.
Perfect. and so what can people expect? What is the full Melon Bomb experience? You know, you play at different places in Ibiza. Mm-hmm. Do you tailor your sound to the different environments, or are you always like, we've got a following, we've got a sound that the expectation is the crowd want to hear this, or do you think, oh, I've got to play a different sound to a Pasha crowd than to a Pikes crowd?
Yeah, a bit. We do tend to do that, and we tend to think a lot about what we're going to play, and it's always up for discussion, and it's something that we talk about all the time, our sound and what's right and what's not for Melon Bomb and for the crowd. And if we're playing the place where we play probably the truest form, what, you know, where we can be a little bit more underground, I guess, is when we're playing at Pikes. That's our home, it always has been, and we can really play our sound there. And it's a mixture of deep, soulful, funky, disco, a little bit of tech, but not, never for more than two or three tracks. We never play, you know, a whole set of it, but then we'll mix in and out of that stuff, you know, a little bit of acid, but it all goes. But it's always got a bit of soul to it, I suppose, is how we would describe it. Whether it's a soulful vocal or a piano loop or whatever it might be. So it's rooted in a kind of soulful disco sound, I suppose.
Yeah.
But, you know, it moves and evolves, but it's still got that, that's the kind of number one element to it. And and if we're playing at Glitterbox, for instance, we might play slightly different to Pikes because it's you're playing in that kind of Glitterbox crowd, I suppose, which expect more of the disco, so we might play a bit more disco there than we play, but we still put a few chunky ones in there as well, and it kind of works. But yeah, you do tailor it a bit, yeah.
Yeah, and obviously with four of you behind the decks, how does that kind of work between yourselves?
Yeah, we don't often play all four of us together, although that has happened quite a bit this season at Glitterbox. So when we play at Pikes, we usually play one at a time, so we usually get an hour set each.
Yeah.
Or sometimes we'll double up and do back to back, and then often at the end of the night we'll all jump on and just put a record on or whatever, and it's quite fun, you know, for the last hour or something, and include our guests might do that too, because we have guests when we play at Pikes. But when we play at Glitterbox, we've played all four of us, and it kind of works occasionally. Sometimes it goes off in weird directions, and we've decided towards the end of this year that next year, if we do it, we'll probably do it in pairs, an hour at a time. So all four of us might be there, but we'll pair off and change the pairs. And we did that towards the end of the season, and it worked really, really well. Or apart from the closing, we just all jumped on, and it was mad. But yeah, so that's kind of how that works. So when we go out and DJ, when we go off the island, for instance, it's usually in pairs. It's very rare that all four of us go together.
Yeah.
So sometimes singular, but if we can get it, it's pairs.
Yeah, somewhere like Pikes, I suppose they can't get all four of you behind the decks at the same time.
No, we try though. We've had a go. Yeah.
Do you trust each other's tastes in terms of selecting music? And do you have, do you often hear something that once one of the other guys has played and been like, oh, you know, what's that? Or I wish I had that. Or do you run things by each other? How does it kind of work in terms of music selection between yourselves?
Everything you've just said there kind of happens, really. There'll be times where we just, oh, that is brilliant. And we're like, we're nicking each other's records and stuff and like playing it. But we do try to get a, and we keep trying to do this, and it works for a while. We're trying to get a library together of tunes that we all like and can put in together and we can dip from, especially when we're going away to play. And there are times, yeah, of course, when one of us plays something the other one's a bit dubious about because tastes are different and there's four of you.
Yeah.
And it's just something we discuss a lot, and, you know, it's something sometimes it can not cause friction, but it can certainly sort of like, oh, I don't like this one, or, you know, but generally we've got a sound, you know, and that sound works, and we've got an identity that sort of people know us for.
Yeah. And who's the best DJ out of all four?
Me.
Of you?
Obviously. No, I mean, look, you know, everyone's got their own skills.
I don't expect you to answer that.
I would not answer that one. No, everyone probably thinks it's themselves. back to that, I mean, like, for instance, Juan's really like technically good. He's really good at mixing and spin backs, and he does little tricks and stuff, and he's really cool. He's really good at that sort of stuff. Paul's just like got this really, you know, what do you call it? Seamless way of mixing tracks together with FX, and Paul, Ben's got his own style. He's very seamless. We all got our own ways of doing it. You know.
And you mentioned Pikes. You see Pikes as like your home.
Yeah.
And we've spoken to Dawn Hindle on this podcast as well. And like, obviously, she talks about the rock and roll history of that place, hand-built by Tony Pike. There's a lot of kind of ghosts that stalk those corridors and a lot of history.
Yeah.
What does the place mean to you as a collective and personally? Is it a real Ibiza moment to have played there and exist there?
Yeah. We all absolutely love it. It's our number one venue for us to play it on the island. It's just brilliant. It's just so cool. You know, the dance floor is quite small. It'd be nice if that was bigger, but it just is what it is. You know, Harvey plays there, and people like Seth Trox will play there, and tons of really, really cool people still play there. It's just brilliant. It's just there's nowhere like it on the island. It's it feels real. It's got that, as you said, that kind of rock and roll history to it. It's a bit, it's just, it's a beautiful venue. It's just magical. We just love it.
Awesome. And yeah, like you mentioned, yeah, Freddy's, the space is very small, very intimate.
Yeah.
What have been kind of some standout moments for you from playing in there? And are there any moments where it's all gone off and you're like, this is kind of a memorable one for me in terms of moments and tracks and things like that you've been playing?
I'll tell you what, too many to mention, honestly. I have at least once or twice a year, I'm in there and I've played a set and I just think, God, that's the best set I've ever played and everybody loves it. And it's just, I don't know, I can't think of one moment or that was specifically better than any others, really. I feel so at home there. It feels like playing in your own front room. It's really weird.
Mm.
You know, it just feels like you're playing to your family. It's just, it's a lovely experience playing.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. And do you often record a lot of your sets? Do you like listening back to them?
Do you know what, it's weird. We do occasionally record our sets and it's something we're guilty of not doing enough of. And I think this year, next season, we're going to do a bit more of it. We have recorded sets there, but it's interesting. When you do those kind of live sets, for us, we're all very pernickety about listening to stuff back and protecting our image and stuff.
Yeah.
And so we're never satisfied with how they sound as a listening experience as they do when you're experiencing in a club.
Yeah.
If you're doing a mix at home to be released as a mix, you do it completely differently.
Yeah.
When you're in there, you're sort of knocking things out and you're dropping stuff and you're using effects and you're doing it to get a crowd going, I suppose. So we are intending to do some next year. More than we've done this year anyway.
And where else in the world do you guys kind of play? Have you taken the Melbourne experience to Glastonbury?
Yeah, we played at Glastonbury on the blues stage at Silver Haze a few years ago. That was incredible. It was on the Thursday night. Basically on Thursday night at Glastonbury, there's nothing going on, but everybody's there because they turn up on Wednesday and Thursday, don't they? I don't know if you've been before. And so people are just gagging for something to do.
Yeah.
And I think Radio 1 were on until 10 in Silver Haze, and that stopped. And our set started at 10. And then after us, it was Colson and Seth Troxler. So literally, everybody had nowhere to go but the blue stage, and they came, and there was a sea of just thousands in front. It was the biggest crowd I've ever played to, probably about 7,000 people,
yeah.
It felt like, anyway. And that was pure magic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are there any plans to go back?
If they'll have us, yeah. We're hoping they'll invite us back again. if they want us back, we'll be there in a flash.
Yeah.
It's an incredible place to play.
And I suppose that's a huge difference between a small intimate space like Pikes and a massive, you know, sea of people in a festival. Is there any preference in terms of what you prefer playing to?
I suppose we like the kind of small intimacy of places like Pikes, which is also why when we play at Glitterbox at High, we love the toilets, because it's that similar thing, low ceiling, it just goes off in there, doesn't it? It's that kind of real intimacy. So that's kind of what we prefer. But it's also nice to play a big room. Yeah, it's great to you know, we've played the main room in High quite a few times. And as you say, you know, we play festivals and stuff like that, so yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
But I think intimacy is just brilliant. It's like, I don't know, it just seems to work with our sound more, I think.
Yeah, and just the, like, everyone elevates each other in those small spaces, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, and where else in the world have you played that is...
Sri Lanka.
Been out, like, good, bad, ugly, amazing, out there. What's
well, I'm
what's
not going to say...
Experiences?
I'm not going to... We play all kinds of places. You know, we go to the Slopes, we've played in Verbier, and we played in Morzine in France. We played those quite regularly, which is lovely to do, especially après-ski is brilliant. I love playing après-ski. We've played in some dingy little clubs in England. We've played some bars. We've played all sorts of places. And they're all, you know, they're all great, really. We're very lucky to be able to do that. We're playing with Ministry of Sound. We've done that quite a few times. We're playing the Printworks New Year's Eve this year. Two of the guys are going over for that, Paul and Juan. So, yeah, everywhere.
Amazing.
But I say everywhere.
So I want to talk about like Chapter and your artwork. Obviously, you're extremely busy doing that as well. Is it a welcome diversion from music, like kind of your art and your prints and that t-shirt side of things?
Or? Yeah, it kind of feels like it goes together, really, because it's very much a creative process, which is something I missed while I was doing recruitment, knowing that I was a creative person. I was a very, very frustrated creative person when I was working in that industry.
Yeah.
So when I got to Ibiza and it was all unleashed again, it felt just so right. So, welcome distraction. I mean, yeah, I guess it is really. It's just being creative, isn't it? And I love being creative.
And where can any of our listeners buy any of your stuff?
At the moment, you could buy it on my website, www.chapter-art.com. We can buy art prints.
So you can get all your stuff online. Just to kind of circle back there just a second, you mentioned kind of recruitment and being that super creative person, but in a non-creative role.
Yeah.
Are you still kind of in touch with anyone from that life that you had back then? Do they see you now and they're like, wow, this is like a talisman of someone who's given it all up and doing, you know, everything that you ever wanted to do? Or
I stay in touch with one or two people, but one in particular, a guy called Daryl, who used to work for me, who's now taken my old role in recruitment and gone further beyond it, and he's doing really, really well now. And he comes over to Ibiza quite a bit, and actually we went over for his wedding this year. So yeah, I still stay in contact with him. And then I met actually my old boss at his wedding and stuff, and they were quite interested in what I'm doing.
And so you're pretty ensconced in the Ibiza scene, house music, all that culture side of things. What are your thoughts on the state of the house music scene in general, maybe seen from an Ibiza perspective, in terms of do you think it's gone very much one way in terms of VIP culture and these big shiny clubs, or do you think that's places like Pikes and things like that are making a bit more of a comeback in terms of these smaller, esoteric, funky little more intimate things? What's your feeling on the difference between the two?
There is definitely more of a VIP culture now than there was previously, but it's not for everybody. And I've never sat at a table in a club, in a VIP lounge. I've maybe visited one to say hello to somebody that was a set at one, but I've never spent a night there in all my life, in all my years of clubbing in Ibiza, and I don't think I ever will, really. And it's for a different type of person, I guess, than the true clubbers. But it's there, it's not going anywhere, and it'll probably continue to be there. I think it's something that's born in America and was adopted once they saw the club, once the club saw they could make a lot of money out of it. And it helps them to be able to bring certain acts and stuff over because they've got more money. So, you know, you can look at it that way too. It is a thing. It's not the end of clubbing. There's plenty of great experiences to be had, and it's not always found in the big clubs, as you just said. Yes, places like Pikes, I mean, I know that they've had their best year ever in 2019, and I've got some very, very cool things going on there. So it's still very much alive and kicking, and places like DC10 and you know, Underground and all those places, that they're really, really keeping it real. And even some of the certain nights at High and Pasha and stuff, it's not all kind of EDM and reggaeton. It's not all that, although that is there, that exists, that coexists. But even when we were going years ago, there were some strange nights on and stuff. It's always been there. I think you just got to focus on how great the greatness is there, and there's plenty of really good stuff there. It's still the mecca for me.
Yeah. And so what have you got coming up in 2020 that you're excited about?
Yeah, so we've got our regular season back at Pikes, which is once a month. We will be.
And when? What is that? A certain day it's on?
It's usually it's always Friday, and usually the first or second Friday of each month, starting in May and finishing in October. We'll be doing two at Tanit. We do a beach party in Good Friday, which we always do, which is really, really, really good party. Everybody's ready for something by then on the island. And then we also do a September party there, which I think this year is in 2020 is 21st or 22nd of September. We will also be playing at Glitterbox, I think 10 times as the dates we've been offered. And we'll be playing at Pasha, I think IMS week. We have a night there, which is good.
Yeah.
And then there'll be other bits and pieces. But that'll probably be us in Ibiza then with our dates there. And then, yeah, various other festivals and stuff. We're doing Sansi Beat in 2020, and there's a few other things being talked about that we're going to be involved with.
Cool. And what would you, is there anything that you guys as Melon Bomb kind of haven't done yet that you really want to do?
More festivals, I suppose, would be good. But that's starting to happen. Something that we haven't done that we'd love to do. I mean, yeah, play in Bergen, I suppose, in Berlin would be nice, wouldn't it? Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess we just want to continue to grow as a brand and make more, you know, get to more people, really reach more people.
Yeah.
Do you know, it'd be nice to do an essential mix, would be good perhaps on radio, on Radio 1. That'd be nice to get offered to do that. I think that'd be good. We haven't done a boiler room yet, so I suppose that would also be good. I'm hoping those things will happen soon, who knows. And we certainly are looking to get music out, which is something that we haven't done enough of as Melon Bomb, and we are working on that at the moment to try and get some Melon Bomb music out. We are currently putting stuff together for that, so hopefully by the time this goes out, there could be some Melon Bomb music available. I mean, we've done some bits and pieces, but mostly edits and stuff like that that we've done.
Yeah, so it'd be like original stuff that you'd be doing, like sample-based.
Sample-based, but original kind of, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It does in house music.
Original sample music.
Okay, so we're kind of just coming up to the hour mark, which is great. So the last kind of bit will just be talking about the tracks that you've chosen. To kind of wrap it up, what we always do with our guests is we get everyone to pick five tracks for a Spotify playlist that we're doing, called the Perfect Playlist, and people can just kind of put it on shuffle. There's already loads of tracks in there that are good, bad, crazy, really strange, just because of the choices that we asked for. So there's a real kind of breadth of genres and choices, which is all good. And we always ask Catalyst, Floor Filler, Sunsetter, Tearjerker, and the last tune. You've been kind enough to give us your choices up front. So we obviously talked about you know, your first exposure to house music and kind of where it all started for you. So in terms of electronic music, what were the tracks that got you into repetitive beats initially?
Yeah, so my first big electronic track that kind of blew my mind when I was young was New Order's Blue Monday. It was incredible, the sound they were making. I mean, obviously there'd already been Kraftwerk had done similar kind of stuff, and the whole kind of new romantic scene was linked to the electronic scene, but Blue Monday had a bit of an edge to it. It was driving, as we all know. It's just an absolute classic, and it just totally turned me on to that kind of music. But when a couple of years after that, another big track, because I'd sort of got into hip hop and electro, was Afrika Bambaataa, Renegades of Funk. Again, that was just a sort of timeless classic, which is again blew my mind. And the other thing I liked about that album, or that 12-inch at the time, was the artwork on the cover. I don't know if you remember what it looks like, but it's a picture of them all coming, bursting through, all drawn in like a comic book style.
Right, yeah, which is kind I of can picture that.
Is even an influence the artwork I do now. You know, my artwork can be a little bit sort of comic book looking. And it wasn't just the music, it was the artwork as well. Just both of them blew my mind.
Yeah, that whole kind of electro scene. We did an interview podcast with Greg Wilson.
Okay.
Yeah, and talking about that whole kind of, it wasn't like Motown stopped and then dance music started. There was a whole kind of thing between the two in terms of repetitive beats. And, you know, he was kind of singing the praises of electro and really pushing that sound during that period. And a lot of interviews and podcasts that I listen to, other ones, the amount of DJs and people that talk about the Electro Street Sounds albums, if you ever owned those.
I did own them, and a few years later, I did a bit of design work for them, believe it or not. Did some graphic design for them for when they kind of re-released stuff the second time round.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I met Morgan Khan and stuff,
amazing.
They run Street Sounds, but obviously when I was a kid, that was a backdrop to our youth, really.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so a floor filler. Obviously, we're not going to nail you down to you've only got one floor filler, but what was your choice today?
Today, my floor filler is Sun Kids, Rise Up. And a good friend of mine, Ricardo Porteous, actually reminded me of how good that track was when we were DJing, practicing around his house on some vinyl a few years back. And he pulled this one out and said he'd heard Eric Murillo play it in Pasha, and it blew his head. And it just, you know, we'd been up all night on doing things and... And I just remember thinking, this is brilliant. So ever since then, I've kind of, wherever I can, I try and get it into my set. Not all the time, because, you know, don't play the same track all the time. But occasionally, when I do play it, never fails to work. And it never fails to, never fails to work. Yeah. And it's not necessarily that people know it, because it's not the most famous of house tracks. But it's just got something about it that just everybody just gets into, even if they've never heard it before. It's just very gospel and uplifting and powerful.
Yeah, and there's a real kind of rich vein of gospel house kind of currently almost, it seems to be making a
it sort of comes and goes, but it's always there, isn't it?
Yeah,
that kind of gospel sound. I guess that's whole part of the whole religious experience you have, isn't it,
when you
go to a club and drop an Ian first hear that kind of music,
when the angels from above.
Exactly.
Yeah, so a Sunsetter soundtrack, A Perfect Sunset.
Massive Attack, Hymn of the Big Wheel, off of Blue Lines, which to me is still the best ever dance album that you can't dance to.
Yeah.
and that, just Horace Andy's haunting vocal on it, and just the words, and it makes me feel emotional. And when I first started playing at La Salle, when I first started playing in Ibiza, I'd always play that as the sun was going down.
Yeah. So, yeah. No, I was very happy when you sent me through the choices, and that was one of them. Oh. I love that album. Oh. Okay, so a tearjerker.
I've got two. One of them is, and they're not because they're sad songs, but they're just emotional songs. One is John Holt, Help Me Make You Through the Night, and it's one of my mum's favourites as well, and my brother's. And my mum's still with us, which is great. So, but whenever it comes on, we always have a little dance in the family to that track. And actually, we went to see John Holt at Brixton Academy, me, my mum, and my brother, about a year before he died. So it's even more poignant now. It's just a firm family favourite, you know.
Yeah.
Even my dad's not into reggae so much, but even he likes it. And then another one is Primal Scream, Come Together. And it's just because it was our wedding song when we walked down the aisle married. Yeah, we had that played.
Yeah.
And it's just there. It just brings back happy memories of that.
Yeah, that Andy Weatherall production. Screamadelica is that one of those other albums that you can't really dance to it. A couple of dancier ones on it. But yeah, it's one of those ones that's just an incredible piece.
Yeah, also one of my favourite albums. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
The last tune. Finish this off. Crowd are asking for one more.
Okay. I've put down St Etienne, Only Love Can Break Your Heart, and only because at our closing party in October 2019, that was I was given the honour of playing the last track of the night, and we don't always want to play something housey, we play all kinds of things, Bob Marley, anything, just something that the crowd would just surprise them a little bit.
Yeah.
And we'd be playing house music all night and disco and stuff. So I played that. It's very much a down tempo, and everyone loved it. It was just really, really nice experience.
Yeah,
and in fact, also that track was the album we used to listen to on come downs after being clubbing all night in London. We come back and listen to that St Etienne album. So it's always been a favourite of mine.
Yeah, it's that real W Andy Weatherall again, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Andy's there again.
So good. So our final question is always: we are house culture. You are part of the house culture. What does this scene that you're involved with kind of mean to you as a whole, and what's it kind of brought to you in your life? Sum it up.
It just gives you a warm, happy togetherness feeling. Everyone connects. It's even if you aren't on anything, it reminds you of when you were on something. It just takes you back to a time where we're just all like united on the dance floor. You know, it killed football violence, didn't it? It just brought us all together in a time where we were very much not together. And I think lessons could be learned right now. So let's get back to house music, kids. Let's all love each other on the dance floor.
That is the perfect place to finish on, I think, with a final thought. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
House culture.
So how far into your backpacking are you right now? That was great, wasn't it? There's a guy that's living proof that asking the universe or even Tanit to bring goodness into your life can open the doorway to your dreams. Thanks, Scott, for an inspiring chat and an extremely candid interview there right from the off. I can't wait to get melon bombed on a future dance floor somewhere. As I said at the top of this episode, pretty much all dates discussed in here are in a state of flux. So if you're looking to catch Scott and the guys on a dance floor somewhere, please check before you book anything. And if you can't wait, you can check out their Wicked When Life Gives You Melons mixes currently ripping up SoundCloud. And if it's more sick beats you're after, you can find all of the tracks we rapped about on our Spotify playlist. Just open up your player, search for House Culture Perfect Playlist, and you'll be presented with a plethora of tunes that feature sounds from every corner of this thing we call house, all chosen by our podcast guests, past and present. Once you've followed the Perfect Playlist on Spotify, please support this podcast by loving, liking, tweeting, sharing, by leaving us a rating or a review on Apple. This is really important and will help us continue to create these episodes we hope you love listening to. and could also get you a shout out on a future one as well. Which leads me to say a huge thank you to the person who goes by the name of Luca Duca, who reviewed us on Apple, saying that our eclectic mix of dance music heavyweights is by far the best pod in its genre. Wow, high praise indeed. Thanks for taking the time to write something so complimentary, and make sure you spread the word of House Culture. Speaking of which, make sure you hit up our Instagram feed at HouseCultureNet, or follow the hashtag TrueHouseCulture, and you'll be kept informed of all the parties that are currently happening in people's homes across the world. I don't know about you, but I'm absolutely itching to hit the club soon. And finally, if you want to reach out to me, Matt Rouse, you can do it directly on Instagram at DJ Matt Rouse. Thanks for listening, stay safe, and see you next time.
House Culture.